Well, hi, everyone. Glad to have you along today. I'm Melinda, and this is Midday Connection and starting a new week of programs. Pete Campbell is our engineer today, and Lori Neff is producing, and Julie is answering the phone at 1-877-LIVE-675, 877-548-3675. Don't forget, you can email us at midday@moody.edu if you want as well. Lori takes a look at those. Well, I want to remind you, first of all, as we begin the week, if you'd like to sign up for the weekly Midday Connection email blast that tells you the topic for each program coming up during the week, you can go to our homepage and click on the upcoming programs link and sign up for that email blast. That's middayconnection.org, and it's the upcoming programs link. And you can also find out about our midday devotional on the link on the right-hand side of our homepage. We're really happy about our Daily Seeds devotional, which released last October. Adele Calhoun is today's devotional writer. Here's a quote from Adele from today's entry. "How we wait in life reveals what is in our hearts. In waiting, our attachment to our own agenda rather than God's shows up. In waiting, our need to control shows up." Whoa, control issues. I can relate to that. How about you? Well, you know, we have 70 of our favorite midday guests who've all contributed to our devotional, and our midday staff wrote over 70 entries as well. So check it out at middayconnection.org. Again, that link for Midday Books is on the right-hand side of the page. And when we talk about control, that sounds like some of the things we talked about with Becky Harling during our on-air Bible study last week, as we discovered the definition of meekness is God-reliance, not self-reliance. And we talked about control versus God-reliance. If you want to go back and hear that program, just click on the past program tab at our homepage, and you can find out more about our continuing study under the Midday Spotlight tab at middayconnection.org. And just a reminder, Becky Harling will be with us again on March 12, a week from Thursday. Our study is called Rewriting Your Emotional Script, and we're focusing on the Beatitudes. Well, I hope you had a good weekend. I got to go to a Chicago Bulls game Saturday night and had a blast with friends. Yes, we made fools of ourselves. We found out that the seats on the first floor may be considered the cool seats in the house, but the people up in the rafters definitely have the most fun. We sure did. And the Bulls won, so that was good. And I'm learning having fun and some good laughs along the way are really important and valuable to balancing out our serious, hard working days, aren't they? 7 times in rehab till you really see change. Have you heard that, or do you relate to that, or what's your experience?
Yeah, you know, there's it's a difficult thing to look at, but you know, the general point is taken that people usually need to go to rehab, you know, a number of different times, and I think that's the way we are with most things in our life. Nobody really wants to change significantly. They want sort of external things to change around them. They don't really want to change their internal things and really sit down and do the hard work that it takes to do that. So we're spiritually lazy, psychologically lazy, physically lazy people, and we want it to happen the easy way. Well, this kind of significant change just doesn't happen the easy way. So people being able to go and get more each time that they go to treatment is real important, and for them to really start to understand, well, I really need to invest myself significantly, and it usually takes several attempts for people to invest significantly. Compound that with, you know, our system that we have, the mental health system and addiction system, is a bizarre system, and unfortunately doesn't really give people the length of stay and the amount of care that they need. So instead of going for 30 to 60 days like they need, the insurance company will say, well, we're just going to allow them to go to detox for 7 days and then add another 7 days on top of that, so they'll be there for 14 days. And so really, when you add up the amount of days that the person goes for those 7 times, oftentimes that is really what a one stay should have been like for them to really get the care and intervention and start to understand and apply those skills and be better at them to be able to be discharged and be more successful, rather than the, you know, the 5 or 6, 10-day stays that they end up getting most of the time through their insurance.
That's helpful to know. And, you know, now I feel like I may have sounded kind of flippant when I said I hear it takes 7 times in rehab to get it right. But before we point fingers, you know, over that, I think, too, I'm thinking for myself, takes me a lot of times to go back to something that God's trying to change in my life before I get it, if I do. And, you know, none of us can really point fingers at alcoholism treatment or anything. I mean, in our lives, it does take all of us time to change those habits. And this is another place where that's true as well. We're all kind of in the same boat in that way, aren't we? Well, we need to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the signs of alcoholism, and the phone lines are open, 1-877-LIVE-675 for your questions, or you can email us at midday@moody.edu.
The other night, my husband was calling our 13-year-old Dachshund to come get a treat, but she wasn't budging. Hi, I'm Renee Swit for Proverbs 31 Ministries. We joked about Chelsea having selective hearing since it was...
I listen daily, but today was just my day.
Well, we're glad you called and made a first step today. Carl, what else would you add?
Yeah, you know, I would say that, you know, what you're feeling is a lot of raw emotions about it, and obviously there is, we don't know all the details, but certainly some significant struggles and things that you want to change and things that you want to, you know, you process and want to glorify God in, and that's fantastic. Now trying to figure out, well, you know, who can help coach me through that process to really, you know, break down my thoughts, my emotions, my decisions, both past and present, so they can really understand God's truth and really apply it very specifically to these areas of life that I really need to have some effect on. And, you know, in your area, whether it's through a church or whether it's through a Christian school or being, if there's a Christian Yellow Pages, to find a, you know, a Christian therapist, if you want to call our organization, we have a hotline that helps people access Christian care. You can certainly do that, and we can find somebody in your area. But having that coach and mentor to guide you and your husband through this process, I think you guys are ready to heal and really want that, and God will provide that for you.
Isn't it interesting? We were talking about the church sometimes being shaming, and Debbie's experience was so different. The church was, like, indifferent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's raw. And sometimes it's, you know, these are those kind of areas where I think whenever an organization or a person doesn't really understand, well, how do all these, you know, there's a zillion pieces of the puzzle there, you know, God, the Holy Spirit, my Bible, psychiatric medications, a therapist, alcohol, sin, you know, we can go on and on about all the different pieces. When people don't really understand, well, how do these pieces all fit together and affect each other and don't have a solid understanding of that, then when somebody throws a curveball in, they don't really know how to react. They don't really know how to assimilate that curveball and be able to use the system that they have that's full, that addresses all these things, that has those components together in the right way, and then can easily absorb that curveball to understand, well, then what do we need to do in response to this? And I think this is an example of, you know, you have some vague notion that, this, boy, this doesn't seem right, but I'm not quite sure psychologically, spiritually, physiologically, relationally, how does this really fit in? And people, you know, are waiting for somebody to step up to say what this really is, but nobody really knows because nobody's not that sure, and they don't want to put their nickel down on something they're not sure of, so they just let it ferment, and, you know, ugly situation ends up arising.
Yeah. And, you know, we actually at Midday hear this so often that it seems like the church, the pastor, the elders are unsure of how to handle some of these issues that we talk about, be it domestic violence or pornography or today alcoholism, that we are beginning to talk to others in Christian leadership about, you know, how this is being handled and taught in our seminaries.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be a bit of a disconnect as to how much time is given for training for future church leaders, and then also...
And you just need to do these spiritual things, but there's no psychological or physiological component. And I really come down on the side of both. You know, I really believe it is sin and disease, that there are choices that we make that are sinful choices, like we talked about. There's worship issues, there's idolatry, there's things we're using to soothe us and to comfort us and to give us peace that are hollow, that are counterfeit, that aren't really going to do that, but that we look to, and alcohol being one of them. So it is sinful choices, but then those sinful choices do contaminate our brain and our body in significant ways. And when it contaminates our brain, that then is disease. That's the definition of disease. So it starts off as sinful, it becomes disease. As our mind becomes diseased, our brain chemistry and our psychological makeup, it makes it easier to sin more, which makes it more dysfunctional brain chemistry, which makes it easier to sin more. And they just keep on ping-ponging back and forth. in the process, and it just is such a myriad of problems. The significant element of that is that, you know, the decisions that you make actually affect your brain chemistry. So when you make poor brain or poor decisions, you impact your brain poorly, and when you make good decisions, you impact your brain in a positive way. And I think that's where the renewing of the mind, when it talks about in Romans, you know, being transformed by a renewing of our minds, it's a renewal that's certainly spiritual, but it's also psychologically and physiological renewal of the brain that takes effect. And God has given us that decision-making process in the Word of how to make decisions and how to make good decisions to allow us a process to renew our mind. Mm. The bad thing about substances is you got that decision to use the substance, so that impacts the brain adversely, but you also got that, this toxin that is very toxic to our brain chemistry and to the rest of our body that impacts our brain adversely. So it's really a double whammy, and that's why substances are so difficult to deal with, because we got that decision that's hurting our brain and the actual toxin that's hurting our brain. That's why that need to get some significant space and time from the substance and get some sober time to allow a brain to really clear out and allow some of that disease to recover so that we can start to work on, well, what are the spiritual issues that are going on in this process that are ping-ponging back and forth to create this sin-disease process from happening.
Well, and I really appreciated 2 weeks ago today, Dr. Matthew Stanford of Baylor was on with us talking about mental illness, and he pointed out that in the Garden of Eden, in the fall, you know, every part of us succumbed to sin. So it's our mind, our emotions, our physical bodies, our spiritual hearts as well. And I hear you saying that too. It all is knit together and affects each component.
Exactly. You know, and I think Satan, you know, we got these three spheres, spirit, mind, and body, and I think Satan, he can't get at us spiritually directly.
So it was good to have some of that good fun over the weekend. I hope you got some, too. Well, today we want to say hi to our friends listening to us in Newcastle, Pennsylvania on WVMN, which seems appropriate since our guest today is also from PA, although at the other end of the state. Dr. Carl Benzio is the founder and director of Lighthouse Network and a board-certified psychiatrist. And in addition to his roles in the Lighthouse Network, he directs Lighthouse Psychiatry, his outpatient practice, through which he provides Christ-centered treatment, counsel, education, and consultation to individuals, churches, and organizations. And Dr. Benzio has also served on various nonprofit boards. He's a church elder, has taught Sunday school, and has been a speaker to many different audiences. And just in our emailing with each other, I know he's really passionate about bringing life change and help to people through biblical answers. Today, we're talking with Dr. Benzio about alcoholism. So how has alcoholism touched your life, your family, friends, coworkers, maybe you? Our phones are open for your calls, or you can email us at midday@moody.edu. And again, our phone number is 877-LIVE-675, or that's 877-548-3675. And Dr. Benzio, welcome to Midday Connection.
Hey, well, hello. Thank you.
Looking forward to today's program because we haven't done this topic in a while. But when we do, we get a lot of response. Alcoholism really is a problem in our society. And I know you've probably got stats for us on society at large and then maybe even in the church.
Sure. Society at large, 66% of people drink alcohol. 10% of the drinkers drink 50% of the amount of alcohol consumed. So it's really a small percentage that drinks so much of the alcohol consumed in our society. Mm-hmm. 40% of people in our society will have an addiction at some point in their lifetime: tobacco, caffeine, alcohol, gambling, food, shopping. So 40% of our society in their lifetime will have an addiction.
Just almost
an amazing
half.
Number. Almost half. Unbelievable. 18% of our society will develop alcohol dependence or abuse. And 7% of our people right now, one out of every 14 person, has an alcohol problem. Mm. Amazing issue that we have.
Yeah.
And you see it on our TV, commercials, billboards, advertised all the time.
So it's one out of every 14.
One out of every 14 people. Now, about half of the people in our society have a first-degree relative. That's a spouse, a child, or a parent that has had an alcohol problem in their life. So half of the people have a very close relative with an alcohol problem.
It was her bedtime, or maybe she's going deaf. My son Andrew looked at me with concern on his face and said, "Mom, I hope you don't go deaf like Chelsea when you get old." I laughingly asked why, and he said, "'Cause sometimes you don't hear me now. Like when you're on the computer and I ask you a question, you don't hear me." Ouch! I wasn't expecting that answer. But instead of drowning myself in guilt, I pulled him close and apologized. I told him from now on, I'm going to stop what I'm doing and really listen when he talks to me. You know, listening is a gift we can give to those we love. It doesn't cost much, and we give it every time we stop what we're doing and turn our full attention to them. For more encouragement, visit Proverbs31.org.
I'm Jim Burns with today's Homeward Snapshot.
What do you mean they lost my invoice? I've got a big meeting here tomorrow. That shipment has to be here no later than 9 sharp, all right? Good. Call me as soon as you hear back from them.
Wow, Dave, weren't you getting a little rough with that supplier?
That's no supplier. That's my mom. Tom, I'm 27 years old. You think after all this time she'd get my dry cleaning to me on time?
You know, that would be almost funny if it weren't so true in the case of many young adults today. There's a new term for many 20-something adults. They're called adolescents. In other words, they're 25 years old but have the life skills of a teenager. If you're a parent, you've got to remember that your primary purpose with your kids is to raise them to be responsible adults, not just really great kids. And to help you do just that, I've written a new tip sheet called Helping Your Kid Become a Responsible Adult. You can download a free copy from our website at homeward.com.
I want to let you know that CDs are available of Midday Connection programs. There's an icon on our homepage on the right-hand side at middayconnection.org. And also want to put the word out that we have another midday hike coming up at the end of May. And so stay tuned for details about that. Carol Reuter and Debbie of Trailbound Trips are going to put a trip together for us, and we're headed north to Wisconsin again, different location than our October hike, but we'll have a limited amount of spaces, but we'll let you know when it's time to sign up for a Midday Connection hike coming up at the end of May. We're really looking forward to that. Today, our guest is Dr. Carl Benzio, and he is a psychiatrist and very much committed to helping people with, for one thing, their addictions, and through his Lighthouse Psychiatry and Lighthouse Network, he provides Christ-centered treatment to individuals, churches, and organizations. And Dr. Benzio, it's great to have you with us today. And I want to get back into our this propensity for us to want the pastor to be all things on all these issues, which is maybe too high of an expectation. I know last week we talked about divorce and just maybe even the need for someone, if it's alcoholism in the church, a pastor needs to put together a resource list.
Exactly.
To outsource some of that help. And we've got help for you today at our homepage. Dr. Benzio's link to his site at the Lighthouse Network is there, and I know that they would be happy to connect with you and help you wherever you live in the States, finding someone nearby who can help you. So check that out at middayconnection.org. And I know we promised to talk about the signs of alcoholism, so coming up, we will get into that right away and go to more of your questions.
This is the World Vision Update. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. There's an invasion underway in Liberia. The intruders? Tiny caterpillars. Reporter Grant Fuller in Monrovia says they've taken parts of the country by storm.
There have been reports that they've affected 100 villages in Liberia, and there are estimates of approximately 500,000 people who would be affected.
About half the population of Liberia lives in Monrovia, and they haven't seen the worms yet. But Fuller says people who live in a remote rural region say the worms are wreaking havoc there.
They're attacking, you know, lots of farms in rural areas. And also the worms are, or the caterpillars, I should say, are infecting water sources with their feces, which is making people sick when they drink the water from rivers and streams. And people in the city are just hearing news reports about them.
The caterpillars are still on the march in the rural areas. Fuller says there's growing concern the creatures will cross the border into neighboring countries.
There are just reports today of the caterpillars spreading to Ivory Coast, next door to Liberia, and attacking cocoa and coffee farms there, which is significant because Ivory Coast is the world's leading cocoa exporter. And Sierra Leone is also on the defensive, setting up pesticide teams at their border. So it's really becoming a sub-regional problem in this part of West Africa.
Fuller says the newspapers in Liberia have been having a field day with the invasion. Big photos of the caterpillars cover the front pages, with headlines saying army worms destroy crops and endanger lives. Actually, they're the larvae of moths. And they've taken a toll on bananas, plantains, and other produce. Already, the price of some food items has doubled. The government of Liberia and a UN task force are working to eradicate the caterpillars. For the World Vision Update, I'm Peggy Waymire.
That's between us and God, I believe. But he can get our mind and our body through these the spiritual warfare and attacking us very early, you know, in our life when we're 1, 2, 3 years old, to really get at our brain chemistry and to get at our personality and our psychology and our emotions and our understanding of things, because he wants to do that in order to keep us spiritually lost, spiritually disconnected with God, so that we don't make, you know, he wants us to be so contaminated about relationships and so burnt and so hardened to relationships that when we come to that age of accountability and have a decision to make about God, do we want to have a relationship with God? Satan wants us so burned about relationships and looking to something else to have a relationship with that we, you know, will say no to God and, you know, go a different way with things, whether it's to alcohol or whether it's to sex or whether it's to isolation or depression or whatever. That's Satan's goal for us, and unfortunately in our society we play into that very well.
And speaking of relationships, it also affects legacy, family legacy. You know,
it
when
sure
he
does.
Can get one, it affects many. And Laura also kind of touched on this topic of family of origin. Is there a connection? Is there a thread when mom and dad are alcoholics or other family members of it being, you know, are you more susceptible?
Yeah, there certainly are. You know, there's, you know, we've been trying to figure out, is there a genetic component, you know, to alcoholism? Is there something that's passed on, you know, through the genes that predispose somebody to alcoholism? And, you know, I haven't really seen hard data that shows that at this point. There's certainly things that sort of imply, you know, there's something there. And I think it goes more like this. I think we're, you know, God wires us and designs us in a certain way so that our personalities, we're not all Robotrons and all the same. We all have our own distinct personalities and ways of communicating and being outgoing or introverted or those kind of things, and they fall upon a normal spectrum. Then spiritual warfare and Satan gets a hold of them through our families of origin and the society we grew up in and the schools and bullies on the playground and those kind of things to take and thwart some of those personality traits. So as an example, take somebody who was born with a very sensitive nature and a very sensitive heart and spirit. And when in the right nurturing environment, that person can be very sensitive and very empathic and very understanding and in tune to people that have been through difficult situations. And they can become a great therapist, a great spouse, a great caretaker, a great parent by being able to really understand and connect to the people that are around them. But if that's trampled on and abused and taken advantage of, then that person becomes very fearful and very worried, and they have sensitivity to a lot of things that they don't have very much confidence or ability to take care of, and they feel then responsible for other people's feelings instead of seeing it as an opportunity. 95% of people with their problem, if untreated, will die of their addiction. So alcohol is our sixth leading cause of death in our country.
Alcohol addiction is the sixth leading cause of death.
Correct.
Okay.
All kind of different, whether it's motor accidents, liver cirrhosis, falls, cancer, stroke, diabetes. It's such a toxin to our body in so many ways, not just to our brain and to our spirit, but also to our body. It's the sixth leading cause of death in our society, alcohol-related deaths.
How about the Christian community?
Now, the Christian community has, it's been hard to get statistics. Borna periodically does some surveys, and what they found in most of the statistics is that the Christian community really does not differ very much in all mental health aspects, whether it's anxiety or depression or post-traumatic stress disorder. And alcohol and addictions fall into that category. The Christian community really doesn't have much statistical difference than the United States community at large. Suicide is about the only situation where the Christian community has less struggle with that. But as far as addictions and alcoholism, the rates are exactly the same as what you see in our general society.
Mm, that's interesting. As we look at some of these issues on Midday, we hear whoever our guest is often say that the statistics aren't very different in some of these life-controlling problems. I suppose it would be hard to get Christians to own up to the fact in any kind of research study that that they do have a problem with alcohol, because it seems like it's a weakness in our faith and we're not living, you know, how Christ wants us to. So it seems like Christians would be hard pressed to maybe speak up about their addictions or problems with us.
Well, that's exactly true. I mean, it's such a big stigma just in our general society, talking about mental health issues or addictions particularly. But even in the Christian community, you can just sort of multiply that by, you know, a zillion, it seems like. And it's just very difficult just for the reasons you said. Is it sin? Is it lack of faith? Is it not praying hard enough? Is it some curse? Is it being out of favor with God? So it's really a guilt-ridden, shame-oriented problem, and then trying to figure out, well, who do I go to? Unfortunately, we see many Christians that instead of going to their pastor or their elders or Sunday school teacher or just somebody in their congregation, they're so embarrassed and so guilt-ridden by it. And the culture in the church has created some distance between the person who is overtly addicted and the rest of the congregation, that afflicted individual ends up going to get secular treatment. So they'll reach out, they'll get secular treatment, but then they won't get the truth. They won't get those spiritual nuggets and pearls from the Word that they need to really.
With SRN News, I'm Linda Kenyon in Washington. President Barack Obama names Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius as his choice for Secretary of Health and Human Services. The announcement comes just days before President Obama holds a White House summit on health care. The Coast Guard says it has found a person clinging to an overturned boat off Florida's Gulf Coast. Officials can't yet confirm if it's the same boat that was reported missing early yesterday. That boat was carrying two NFL players and two other men. Insurance giant AIG is reporting a fourth quarter loss of nearly $62 billion. The government is extending the company another $30 billion of aid on top of the $150 billion it got just a few months ago. The announcement was followed by a plunge of the Dow below the 7,000 mark. School is out for more than a million East Coast students today, thanks to a massive winter storm that is blanketing the region. More details at srnnews.com.
I'm Melinda, and this is Midday Connection. And tomorrow, Dr. Erwin Lutzer will be with us in the studio. We're going to have a discussion about Oprah. Oprah and her best-selling friends, Eckhart Tolle, Rhonda Byrne, and Marianne Williamson. And we're going to take your questions as well. And Oprah sure is ready to write a check for, you know, causes all the time, but kind of has shaped her own version of Christianity. And so Dr. Lutzer is going to help us discuss that and kind of net out what Oprah and her own kind of faith, her brand of faith is all about. I know many watch her program and follow her, and it's good to be up on what she's all about. So that's coming up tomorrow. Today we're talking with Dr. Carl Benzio and taking your questions, email, and phone about alcoholism. And we've promised to look at the signs of alcohol addiction. What are those, Carl?
Yeah, the classic signs of alcohol addiction are, one is that there's a tolerance, meaning that tolerance to the same amount every day builds up so that you need more as time progresses to get the same effect. So initially, if you needed just two drinks or three drinks to get a buzz or feel a little euphoric or feel relaxed, now after you've used it for 3 or 4 months, now you need 4 or 5 drinks. Mm-hmm. So that's tolerance. Another one is withdrawal, where if you have been drinking fairly regularly and you stop drinking, you end up getting anxious or have a withdrawal or a detox process that goes on. And depending on the substance, it's a little different. But for alcohol, it can be very dangerous and get the DTs and have seizures and even die. And it's the only that and certain medications are the only withdrawal help people with other feelings. So then because of that pain or that guilt or that responsibility, they can start to self-medicate with alcohol or workaholism or, you know, a whole bunch of different things we talked about earlier. And I think that's where some of the genetic sort of predisposition comes in more for personality type, not necessarily for a particular disorder. The disorder comes from the, you know, the spiritual warfare, our sin nature, and sort of how they collide to affect that personality that God originally created us with.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Laura, for your question. We had a call from Roxy in Tennessee and haven't been able to get her on the phone, but definitely want to ask her question and kind of fits into our conversation about home life. My father was an alcoholic. I never knew what normal was, and I still struggle with that. And so growing up in a home, you know, maybe you're not addicted yourself, but talk about the alcoholic home.
Yeah, boy, this is, you know, there's actually some community support and self-help groups called ACOA, Adult Children of Alcoholics, because this has just been, you know, such a significant problem, a fairly typical kind of problem that we see. And as we said, there's so many people with alcohol problems in our society. So obviously they're having kids, and those kids are growing up in situations. You know, one of the patients I treated, you know, really had difficulty with success and had a difficulty feeling good about herself and was always nervous when something good happened. And what we look back is, you know, growing up in a family with her dad being an alcoholic, she remembered times where she would come home with a very good report card or, you know, a 100 on her spelling test, and she would show it to her dad, and her dad would hit her and just want another beer or be angry about something that didn't go well at work. And so in her mind, she started to associate, you know, something, you know, when you tell somebody something good happened or when something good happens, you could have potential consequence or potential adversity with it. And that's just a typical of growing up in an alcoholic family, just the uncertainty of things, the inconsistency of what happens, so, you know, walking, either waking up in the day or coming home from school and having no idea what condition is my parent going to be in. Are they going to be one who's very effusive with love and with care?
Who will
and
be there?
Feeling guilty about what they had done the day before, so they're trying to make up for it to me, or are they going to be intoxicated under the influence and irritable, angry, physically violent, or those kind of things? It's just so random. So
I hear you advocating that those who grow up in a home where there's been a problem with alcoholism, they really need to take a look at some of their own fears, their own issues. They're a very discussion and maybe pick up where we left off.
Yeah, you raised a great point just before the break there, Melinda, of, you know, we all have areas that we struggle in that take a while for us to make a dent in and to overcome. And I really think that, you know, we really all are addicts. And I think what our addiction to is to comfort. So everyone, all people are really addicted to comfort. And a lot of the dysfunctional things we do are there to really soothe us or protect us from being uncomfortable or being in discomfort.
Can I ask you, is alcohol, a lot of people turn to alcoholism for comfort maybe. You maybe turn to a donut or to shopping or TV or drugs. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. You know, whether it's anger, whether it's being controlling, whether it's workaholism, you know, there's certain things that each person has some discomfort with, whether it's being out of control or physical pain or emotional loneliness or not feeling important. There's those, you know, arrows that Satan has sort of attacked us with, and that we have, you know, those difficulties and those discomforts. And instead of looking to the Lord to help us through that and to give us peace and to bring us comfort, you know, in our growing up, we've developed these dysfunctional mechanisms to soothe, to escape, to disconnect, to numb, to self-medicate is a common term that you hear. And so we all have those areas of struggle. And I think it's important for for church culture to really understand that, because a lot of times in churches we see the, you know, sort of the haves and the have-nots, the people that don't have any difficulties and the people that have a lot of difficulties, and even though we say we love them, they know that they're not really accepted. They're really looked at quite differently. And so I think for church culture, it's important for us all, and to hear from the pulpit, that we're all addicts. We all have misplaced worship. We all have times we're not worshiping God in all that we do. And so that makes it then easier to understand those people that have pornography or homosexuality or heroin addiction. It's easier to understand and to empathize with them because we know that we have struggles. They might not be as glaring or as as morally abhorrent as, you know, as my predilection for donuts or to need to watch ESPN sometimes when I'm getting angry or something. But it's the same mechanism of not really going to God to meet my need, of going to something else that's a lot more trivial and more hollow in being able to get that need met.
Idolatry of some kind, huh?
Exactly.
I really like your list because it's not a trite list. You talked about feelings of loneliness and anger and all sorts of things. And also, you mentioned the haves and the have-nots, the ones that seem to have it together and the ones that don't. But as we know, the ones that seem to have it together, I mean, I'm convinced once the front door is shut on one's home, you don't know what's going on behind the doors. So,
exactly.
You know, even those that look like they have it together, no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're all struggling because of sin, and Page is a place you can click on and link to that site and see what's there. Here's an email, Carl, from a listener. My mom died last June from kidney failure due to liver failure, from alcohol, had cirrhosis of the liver for 12 years, continued to drink, broke lots of bones, ended up in a wheelchair from falls related to alcohol, lost homes, filed bankruptcy, lost friends, lost her mind due to high toxicity from liver failure, continued to drink. This emailer says, I grieve my mom's losses and circumstances. I'd like to use it for good. Do I have a right to share her story or not? Would it dishonor her to let people know what alcohol did to her or what she did to herself? Who would benefit, etc.? She feels like sharing it too would help her sort it out.
Yeah, I think that, this alcohol just is such a terrible, terrible way to die. She just listed some of the things. It's just so sad to see somebody go that way. I think it would be okay to share that story. I think it's a powerful story. I think it's a story that can change people's lives.
Yeah.
I think certainly for the daughter, I think, you know, it would help her in some of the healing process and being able to understand it and wrap her mind around it and really reach out to God to help her process it. But I think it can impact other people's lives, and it's not something that's going to embarrass the mom because she's not around to deal with that embarrassment. I think it's will be something that she would want.
Yeah.
She wouldn't want other people to go through what she went through.
Yeah.
And if this could help other people avert that kind of ending, I think her mother would be happy about that, that
and
something came out of her demise.
God is about redeeming
exactly.
our stories and about redemption, and boy, there's a way to do it. Thanks for that. Let's go to one last call. Jane's calling from Indiana, listens to us on WGNR. And Jane, we're right down to the wire with our time. So quickly, go ahead with your comment or question.
I'm the wife of an alcoholic husband who had been sober for 3 years and was actually mentoring other people through AA. And when he and I just started going to church and really being serious about Jesus, then he started drinking again, which he never understood, you know, why he had started doing that. And after having 3 years of sobriety and knowing how wonderful that was, I felt angry inside, and I felt powerless, you know, to try to make him quit again. And I became very critical of his drinking, and his drinking just got worse. And then I finally realized, you know, that this is God's situation to fix. And, you know, I turned it over to him. You know, I'd ask God, you know, to help me help him. And the first thing that he showed me was that I have many faults myself, and to stop being so angry at him that wasn't helping him, you know, and he's not perfect, and I'm never going to be perfect, and I just think that one of the things that that can even exacerbate alcoholism is that when the person that's an alcoholic comes home and then their wife or other family members just, you know, get on them and get angry with
supportive.
Them, and that just makes them want to drink even more.
Carl, any thought from you on that?
Oh, Jane, God bless you. That's fantastic. You were able to sort of see God's you know, God's view of your life and God's purpose for your life. And that's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. And realize it's not between you and your husband. It's between you and God first. That's so important. The second thing I want to point out is it is okay to be angry at your husband. Mm. Okay? That's just a warning sign letting you know, hey, something's not right. Something's going on. Now it's your choice to figure out, well, what are you going to do about that anger? Are you going to say, okay, we have a problem. I'm getting warned about it. Thanks, God, for that warning system. Now I need to figure out what the problem is and what's the godly way to address that problem.
Oh, wow.
That's fine. Being angry is fine. Don't suppress that anger because it's going to come out some other ways. But that doesn't mean you go off and you whack him over the head or you come and belittle him when he comes in. All that is just a warning sign. You can go to him and say, hey, husband, you know, I'm a little bit angry with you, and that tells me that there's some problem going on. Let's put our heads together and let's bring God into this and figure out how can we help solve this problem.
As we close today, Carl, we've had calls from people who are like at their wit's end. Just quickly, like in 30 seconds, what would you say to encourage them? You know, they've got kids at home. Things are really difficult. What's a next step?
Yeah, there always is hope. There always are options. You know, God will provide options. There are options. There are Christian options to be able to help people with this struggle. There are places around the country that deal with this issue. There are interventionists that if a person doesn't want to get treatment or they're in denial, that will help intervene and do an intervention in the process. So there is help available. That's what our organization does, is help Christians access Christian care.
Okay. That's Dr. Carl Benzio. Been a great conversation with you, doctor, and appreciate that. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Melinda. Have a great day.
You too. And also want to direct you to middayconnection.org, where you can link to the Lighthouse Network if you need a next step of finding a place of maybe intervention for a family member or other help. They want to help you find it. So go to middayconnection.org and click on that link. Tomorrow, Dr. Erwin Lutzer, we're talking about Oprah and her style of faith. And I'm Melinda. Glad to be with you today. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow for Midday Connection.
Don't forget, if you missed any part of today's program, you can hear it streamed or download the podcast at middayconnection.org. You'll find many other Midday Connection programs there. middayconnection.org. You know, we're grateful for this station that brings you Midday Connection. Encourage the staff in whatever way you can. Thanks again for listening. This program is a production of Moody Radio.
Life change and life transformation, and so they go get secular care, which sometimes is good, sometimes it isn't, and then they'll come back, and some will be able to utilize that and to really grow, but often many of them will then stumble again and then again go to secular because they're so afraid to be outed in the church or to let somebody know that they have an issue just because of the way oftentimes churches handle these situations.
Yeah, unfortunately, we can be very shaming in the church.
Yeah.
And I know that secular treatment has helped a lot of people. What is it about the added dimension of Christian treatment that you see to be so helpful?
Well, I think one aspect of it is that when you go to a Christian facility for treatment, you're working with Christians, and Christians will... the Christian workers just take it as their mission, and the ability to love and extend God's compassion and care and mercy to somebody, and their acceptance is just a very profound, profound thing. That's one of the obviously what Jesus did for us and acceptance, and what we can be to others as lighthouses to help really them.
And that is that's a big thing to talk about the Christian commitment and passion and commitment to the mission of life change. Is very real in the Christian treatment world.
Yeah, and that relational aspect of things is very very powerful. Mm-hmm. Then with that, you're then infusing prayer, infusing the truth, and trying to, one of the big things that Satan does, he's the great deceiver. So we have so many distorted lenses in our society, and from our sin nature, and from Satan's spiritual warfare throughout our lives, and alcohol. Amplifies those distortions in many ways. So being able to learn, well, what is the truth? What is the real way to see relationships, our marriage, money, pain, struggle, peace, authority, so many things that Satan has done a great job of distorting. Mm-hmm. So being in that Christian programming allows for very clear, giving us eyes that see and ears that hear the truth. And then hopefully a person is there for a long enough period of time that they're to learn those skills to be able to apply that truth, because a lot of people get the idea that spiritual knowledge equals spiritual growth. And spiritual knowledge doesn't equal spiritual growth. Spiritual knowledge, when applied, then becomes wisdom. That's where spiritual growth occurs. So they need to be in the situation to be able to get the spiritual knowledge, but then be able to be coached, tutored, discipled, mentored to be able to apply that truth to their very specific baggage, issues, struggle areas, to really develop a different way of both behaving on the external, but then also really transforming their heart for true life transformation.
What did I hear lately? It takes...
all that is actually medically dangerous, and that's where detoxes and rehabs really came out of in the early 1900s because of that, those deaths that would occur.
Mm-hmm.
Other psychological things are, pursuing, or spending a lot of time trying to pursue a substance or activities related, to drinking, whether that's partying, whether it's visiting multiple doctors to get a substance, those kind of things. Impairment in functioning. So whether it's a teenager, an impairment in school functioning and homework, withdrawal from extracurricular activities, whether it's an adult and they have work-related or occupational difficulties, calling out sick, tardyism, difficulties with coworkers, and certainly the hugest impact is on families, marriages, anger in the home, difficulty managing your emotions, irritability, frustration, poor frustration tolerance, disengagement with your spouse or with your kids, just a lot of significant relational impact in the process. Usually people have tried to cut down, or they think of cutting down a lot of times, or have persistent thoughts of wanting to cut down and just unable to, or other people have told them that there's an issue and they need to cut down.
Mm-hmm.
And probably lastly is just the continued use, even though there's, whether it's physical difficulties with their GI or with the liver, the stomach, or work-related legal implications, that even with those significant warning signs that say, hey, look, there's a problem here, you need to stop, people either try or sort of blow through those warning signs and they still continue to use. Those are some of the main indicators of an alcohol problem or alcohol addiction.
Okay. We've had an email from Laura, and she says, I have firsthand experience on this subject as I'm recovering myself, and I have a parent who was an alcoholic. I didn't get clean till age 40. I became a Christ follower at age 20. However, I do believe this is a disease. I believe you have the traits growing up. I have four siblings, and I was the only one who used. I was also a heroin addict. She says, I want to so badly talk with someone about this. Raises that issue about how we name this. Is it a disease?
Yeah, this is the classic thing I talk about a lot is addiction. Is it sin or disease? And boy, there's just so much controversy. My medical colleagues call it a disease, and really give credence to, it's this real physiological problem, and all you need to do is do these physiological things, and that's it. There's no psychological and there's no spiritual element to it. Then on the flip side, in the church community, there's this the view that it's just a sin.
Very good grounds for why there might be issues and wide-ranging in their own lives. So we'll come back and follow up with Dr. Carl Benzio and take more of your email and phone questions talking about alcoholism today. Remember, you can hear the program again at middayconnection.org. Go to our past program tab, and CDs are also available for purchase as well. You can link to Dr. Benzio's site at middayconnection.org. The link's right near his picture.
This is a Love Language Minute with author and speaker, Dr. Gary Chapman.
What is the greatest commandment of all? Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Why would you want to love God? The Apostle John said, we love God because he first loved us. Some time ago, I began a study of the various ways in which God expresses his love to us. I discovered that God speaks all five love languages fluently. Words of affirmation, gifts, acts of service, quality time, and physical touch. That study led to the publishing of my book, God Speaks Your Love Language. What makes one person feel loved does not necessarily make another person feel loved. God knows you, and He chooses to speak your love language. For more on understanding God's love, visit 5lovelanguages.com. I'm Dr. Gary Chapman.
This is Dr. Bill Meyer with the James Dobson Family Minute. How often do you stop and evaluate your life? Here's my colleague Dr. James Dobson with a reminder about the importance of prioritizing.
If you just project yourself to the end of your life and you're looking back, what will matter to you? What will the value system be like then for you when you're assessing the worth and the value of your life? What will matter will be those relationships with your children, with your family. And if it'll matter then, why not get excited about that system of values now?
Let's face it, no one wants to live a life of regrets. Yet how often do we take time to reflect? A few moments of contemplation today could make a lifetime of difference tomorrow. Live your life in a way that you can be proud of when you look back on it. For more on having a healthy family, go to family.org.
Our last segment here on Midday Connection is we've been talking about alcoholism with Dr. Carl Benzio. Would love your feedback at midday@moody.edu. He is the founder and executive director of the Lighthouse Network, and you can link to that really helpful site from our homepage at middayconnection.org next to his bio and picture on our homepage on the fall way back.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about the church, and Debbie wants to weigh in on that. Debbie, calling from Indiana, listens to us on WMBL. And I guess, Debbie, that you've got firsthand experience with the church around our topic of alcoholism today?
Yes, we do. My husband and I drank as, you know, recreational. It was just something we really had in common. And we took it, you know, into the church with us. We were pretty grounded in this church and, you know, youth leaders. And the question came up, you know, is this, I think the Lord started convicting us about it. And, you know, we were like, well, is this acceptable? And so, you know, we took it to our pastor and it was talked about within the elders, and, you know, they didn't want to be too judgmental, and, you know, what you did was in your home and, you know, this and whatever, that's okay. You know, we're not going to judge you for that. And we became youth pastors, and we just thoroughly enjoyed it, just loved it. And we would have functions for the kids, you know, here at the at our home, and alcohol was brought into it. Mm. And to make a long story short, eventually things just totally got out of control. I had been praying for quite some time that God would reveal this problem because we were just not comfortable with it, but yet we weren't, you know, stopping either. Mm. And
it doesn't sound like the church leadership stopped you either. They said,
no,
well,
that's what's so crushing about it, you know. That's what we just, and it's been, you know, years now. It's probably been 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not able to, you know, we left the church. We confronted the church, apologized to them, you know, about things that happened. But during this function where the alcohol was involved, you know, all the church was here, the pastor and, you know, everyone was here.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just, you know, it got out of hand. We apologized, we left the church, and it's just impossible for us now. I don't know why. We just cannot seem to get over the guilt of all that and find a church. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're really in tune with God. I read the Bible daily. We pray. Mm-hmm. You know, Jesus is foremost in our lives.
Well, let's
but
talk to...
I miss that fellowship with the church. You know,
yeah.
I just miss that. So, but we
it's
just can't get over the guilt of all of that.
Mm.
You just can't heal from it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think, Debbie, have you worked with anybody as far as a counselor or a therapist to help you process some of these things and internalize that forgiveness that God has for you?
No, today is the first time I've...
Oh, wow.
I don't know. It was just, you know,